Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, friends, colleagues. The morning session ended a little late, so wielding the immense authority that I have been given, I am intending to keep our speakers to their 30-minute limits. And that will also include relatively concise questions and answers and comments by our discussants. Okay, and with that, we'll begin immediately with Professor John Brockington's paper, please.
Thank you. 50 years after completion of the Mahabharata Critical Edition is an appropriate time to review its success, its limitations, and its impact on epic scholarship, along with that of the Ramayana Critical Edition, completed in 1975. I have myself studied the Ramayana more fully and shall rely on that work for much of what I present, but I hope to make my remarks relevant to both epics and more generally to the themes of this conference. Although they're classified by different names in the Indian tradition, for convenience, I shall use the term epics to refer to both texts together. The basic, much debated issue is whether and how far oral performance... The basic, much-debated issue is whether and how far oral performance gave way to manuscript transmission. External evidence is extremely meagre, and so internal evidence, formulaic diction, repetition, duplication of episodes, and the like, has to be the prime source of information about this process of transition. I start with external evidence, which is only relevant for the Mahabharata. Panini's Ashtadhyayi lists the addition of the suffix ka to the names Vasudeva or Arjuna with the meaning of one who has bhakti towards them, and mentions both Mahabharata and some other names, while Patanjali mentions Yudhishthira and Arjuna as older and younger brothers. None of this, though, gives us much clue about what sort of text the grammarians knew, but at Tarnin's date, it must have been oral. More significant, I believe, is the evidence of the Spitzer manuscript, a Sarvastivadin philosophical manuscript datable around the second half of the 3rd century AD, so relatively late in the usual accepted growth of the Mahabharata. However, this dating is merely the terminus antiquam for the text that it contains, and the list itself could have been taken from an earlier text. This manuscript contains a fragmentary parvan list, notable for the absence of both the Virata and the Anushasana parvans, as well as the limited number of paravans between the Bhishma and Shanti paravans, and also probably following the Ashvamedika paravan. The Spitzer manuscript is, in my view, valuable, although incomplete evidence for the shape of the text at the earliest date for which we have any testimony. The internal evidence has mainly been seen in terms of formulaic diction, under the influence of the work of Parry and Lord on Homer and on the South Slavic epics. Indeed, the name oral formulaic theory, usually given to this approach, privileges formulae, perhaps unduly so. It is important to remember that while oral poetry is characteristically formulaic, this does not automatically mean that all formulaic poetry is oral. But what it means for us is that further markers of orality are needed before any text can reasonably be regarded as oral. Berkeley Peabody, working on Hesiod, produced a set of criteria at 5 levels: phoneme, formula, enjambement, theme, and song, and suggested that positive indications were needed for each before a text could firmly be considered a direct product of an oral tradition. While we must beware of the limitations of extrapolating from one language and culture to another without allowing for the inevitable differences, these tests offered me a convenient framework to assemble the evidence for the Sanskrit epics, since they cover a broader range of evidence than do other schemes, and confirmed, with varying degrees of certainty, the oral origins of both epics. Another feature which seems more characteristic of oral poetry than written literature is ring composition. Its earliest significant application to either epic was Renata Zerner's monograph on speeches and dialogues from the Ramayana. She argues persuasively for frequent deliberate structuring of speeches by anaphora, refrains, parallelism and the like, but especially by means of ring composition. An oral origin for both epics has major implications for the duration of their growth periods, which then has implications for issues about design and deliberate literary construction across their whole text, as well as for our assessment of the social, cultural, and religious contexts in which they evolved. The older view of this process of growth as essentially random has long been discarded by scholars who take a diachronic approach, though retained by those who take a narrowly synchronic approach as a stick with which to beat their opponents, discarded in favour of a more nuanced view of it as a design modified and adapted over successive periods. Ironically, the best-known story about the Mahabharata's origin tells how Vyasa, commissioned by Brahma to compose a poem, dictated it to Ganesha as his scribe. This story has no basis whatever in the text established in the critical edition of the Mahabharata. Indeed, Ganesha is absent in any capacity from that text. The Mahabharata text provides a different account of its origin in the first adhyaya, which opens with the sutra's statement to the Brahmins assembled in the Naimisha forest for Sharnaka's sacrifice, that he has come from Janamejaya's great sacrifice, where Vaishampayana told the tales he had heard from Krishna by Vaishampayana Vyasa that constitute the Mahabharata. Here, the epic is presented as being narrated here and then and there, with reciters and audience actually within the text, as well as the further dimension of oral transmission from one reciter to another. The origin myth for the Ramayana also has Brahma commissioning Valmiki to tell the world the story of Rama, and once he has composed it, he wonders who can transmit it, and thinks of Kusha and Lava, then living in his ashrama. So he teaches it to them, and they sing the poem, eventually before Rama himself. In the Uttarakhanda, Valmiki sends Kusha and Lava to recite the Ramayana for the first time at Rama's court. Here then, within the Ramayana itself, although only in later parts, we have just as unequivocal an emphasis on the oral nature of the text as in that Mahabharata's insert story about Ganesha. There is an emphasis on the written form. The length of their growth period also affects the lesser issue of their mutual relationship, in particular whether the Ramopakhyana, a shorter version of the Rama story found within the Mahabharata, is the source for or is derived from the Ramayana. For all of these questions, the evidence of the critical editions, text and apparatus together, is invaluable. Before I continue, let me add that only one view of the relationship between the Ramopakhyana and the Ramayana is compatible with the textual evidence. Not only is the Ramopakhyana based on the Ramayana, but in general it is closer to its northeastern recension. The publication of the critical editions has generated debate, focused mainly on the Mahabharata, about the validity of the criteria used for the selection of readings and even the value of these editions. Some scholars, notably Madeleine Birdo, have rejected the critical edition, regarding it as in essence a fiction, and preferred to use the Vulgate text, in effect the text established by Nilakanta Chaturdhara late in the 17th century, when he wrote his Bharatabhavadipa commentary. Often overlooked, though not by Biardo herself, is that Nilakanta explicitly compared several manuscripts and was well aware of regional divergences. His comments to this effect come prominently at the start of his commentary. His text is avowedly eclectic while aiming at being comprehensive. Appeal to or preference for the Vulgate as more authentic is therefore misguided in my view. The critical revisions are not only on the whole the best we have, despite the limitations that I discuss next, but also permit further advances in our understanding of them. Both critical editions are based on the readings of just a selection of the vast number of manuscripts known. A larger number was initially examined, but then reduced to a manageable number. The principles followed were first enunciated by Suktankar in his Prolegomena to the Adiparvan of the Mahabharata, and were broadly followed by all editors for both epics. These principles comprise grouping the manuscripts mainly by script into versions, relying on agreement between these versions for accepting any passage into the text, in default of attestation in all manuscripts used, and accepting the two axioms of the textus simplicior and the lectio difficilior. Suktanka recognised the impossibility of constructing a stemma canticorum on the classical model and relied on grouping the script versions into primarily the northern and southern recensions. Since these are too far apart to permit the establishment of an archetype solely on the basis of manuscript readings, his and the other editors' constituted text is necessarily eclectic, though based on careful judgment on the basis of the available evidence, and is an approximation to a written redaction of the text that became normative. The same considerations apply, mutatis mutandis, to the Ramayana. The first limitation that must be recognised is the long period of transmission of the texts. Around 2 millennia, on Hilterbeitel's view that the Mahabharata was composed between the mid-second century BC and the year zero by a committee of out-of-sorts Brahmins. More like 2.5 millennia, according to various other scholars. That's to be set against the recent date of most manuscripts. The oldest dated manuscript used for the Mahabharata critical edition is dated 1261 AD, while for the Ramayana critical edition, it is one dated 1020. However, for both epics, the majority of the manuscripts used come from the 16th to 19th centuries. Most are essentially complete, whereas many older manuscripts lack portions of their text. The editor's understandable tendency, despite their good intentions, to choose complete texts may well have resulted in the use of younger manuscripts. Moreover, several scripts are not represented: Oriya, Kannada, and Nandinagari. My own investigations of an Oriya script Ramayana manuscript and of another one in Newari script show that such further evidence leads to a reassessment of the concept of script-based versions in favour of one based more on regional affinities. My investigation of another one in Malayalam script in the Trivandrum collection necessitates a reassessment of the manuscript M4, previously dismissed as contaminated. These two manuscripts share features which indicate that they represent an alternative, and probably older, because shorter, Malayalam recension. The view that the various scripts generated relatively isolated manuscript traditions with little contamination between them goes back as far as Luders. It was reaffirmed by Suktanka in his Prolegomena. I quote, "The superficial difference of scripts corresponds, as a matter of fact, to deep underlying textual differences." But he goes on to state that in practice, matters are never as clear-cut. Moreover, most literate Indians nowadays know more than one script, and there's no reason to think that such was not always the case. Besides, a scribe might have listened to an oral presentation of either epic, or perhaps a reading aloud of a text, in an area or by an individual who was using a script he didn't know, and he could have incorporated some episode that remained in his memory into a subsequent manuscript copying. Certainly, there is ample evidence of scribes deliberately comparing manuscripts, or at least checking one from another, in particular through variant readings found in the margins or interlinearly, sometimes even a different script from the manuscript itself. The supposed barriers of script are in fact highly permeable. We should, I submit, be thinking more in terms of regional groupings that may cut across script differences. The number of marginal or interlinear editions also shows that the texts were commonly enlarged in successive copyings. Accidental loss is always a possibility, but much less likely than accretion. This is, of course, what underlies the principle of the textus simplicior, which governs Suktanka's preference, followed by the other Mahabharata editors, for the Sharadar script manuscripts and other closely related ones, despite their relatively recent date. The Malayalam manuscripts also tend to contain a shorter text, perhaps a feature well known in linguistics that in language change, the periphery leads to a more conservative to be more conservative than the centre also applies here. On the other hand, attestation in all manuscripts is not infallible proof of a passage being part of the original text. It could have entered the tradition early on and then spread to all extant manuscripts, assisted by this habit of comparing manuscripts. The tendency to include everything found in the exemplars available may well account for the duplication of episodes that we find in both texts. A scribe found varying versions in two manuscripts before him, and rather than choose one and reject the other, he incorporated both in an attempt at comprehensiveness at the expense of consistency. So the text even of the critical editions cannot be regarded as a completely coherent whole. A well-known example is the dice game in the Samaparvana of the Mahabharata, and Mahendale has collected multiple examples of interpolations and internal contradictions. Such lateral transfer of passages or episodes, verses between manuscripts is not the only complicating factor. Scribes did not or could not always copy a single exemplar throughout, quite apart from comparing with others. I give an example from each text. In the Mahabharata, the Sabbaparvan manuscript D6 has a text much of the time similar to DN1, a Vulgate text which actually is dated 1570, until a point within the Deutaparvan when it becomes similar to D5 for unknown reasons. For the Ramayana, my example is a manuscript used by Schlegel for his pioneering edition, but not for the critical edition, despite predating most of those used. This is the mid-17th century Jagat Singh, or Mewar Ramayana, best known for its illustrations. The manuscript which its scribe, Mahatma Hirananda, copied was clearly not the same one throughout. For several khandas, his exemplar was sometimes defective, and he puts a few dashes in places of syllables that he could not read, and then the allegiance of the manuscripts is not always the same. Why? When Rana Jagat Singh commissioned this lavishly illustrated manuscript, Mewar had only partially recovered from the sack of its capital Chittor by the Mughals in 1568, which presumably had destroyed the royal library, meaning that Hirananda had to get his exemplars from wherever he could. Whereas the premise that manuscripts written in the same script belong together has significant limitations then, the broader differentiation into northern and southern recensions has a greater measure of validity. But even here, we must recognise that a significant number of manuscripts combine features of both. This is probably more often by a conflation of the two at a relatively recent stage in the chain of transmission, but perhaps sometimes by retention of older features. Again, I cite as my example my research on that Trivandrum Malayalam script manuscript. Although this is close to M4 of the Yogyakanda of the Ramayana, neither could have copied from the other, and their closeness is marked by common absence of material rather than additions, suggesting a fairly early date. Neither, unfortunately, is dated, but may be of 16th century date. However, they both combine features of the present northern and southern recensions. Within the northern recension, they align particularly with two manuscripts, D1 and 2, which are usually assigned to the western sub-recension within the northern recension, and to a lesser extent with the third, V1. The evidence of these two manuscripts, especially when linked with that from another fragmentary manuscript of Trivandrum, shows that they represent a definite alternative tradition current within Kerala, differing markedly from that of M1 to 3, and that it has clear links with the so-called Western recension. A related point is that the supposed uniformity of the southern recension of the Ramayana has been overstated. All in all, the evidence of a large number of Ramayana manuscripts shows that the simple opposition between the northern and southern recensions, however useful it may once have been as a heuristic device, does not adequately reflect the complexities of the chain of transmission involved. And consequently, the question of their relative value is a more complex issue than was recognised in the constitution of the critical edition text. The same is no doubt the case for the Mahabharata too. Another possible approach to the question of the evolution of the text into the present recensions, even if our view of these needs refining, is to ascertain what sort of text the authors of classical Sanskrit dramas and Mahakavyas drew on when they used plots taken from the epics. A related issue is whether there's been any reverse influence between the original Sanskrit texts and their multiple translations or adaptations into the regional vernaculars. These questions are among those that Mary and I are in the process of investigating for the Ramayana. Already, it's possible to state that there is evidence that classical literature relied mostly on the northern recension for the Ramayana texts, as well as the Mahabharata, and that there has been reverse influence from later versions. I give just a few examples of the first. Bhatti knew a text of the Ramayana that was intermediate between the present northeastern and southern recensions. Bhavabhuti's direct quotations show that he knew a version similar to the present northern recension, and specifically the northeastern recension. But the Champu Ramayana, ascribed to Bhoja, follows the southern recension quite closely, as well as being influenced by Kalidasa's Raghuvamsha. So far, I've mainly been demonstrating limitations in the way that the critical editions of both epics classified the manuscript evidence into recensions and script-based versions, relying on what's only a modification of the stemma concept. Can we go beyond this in our understanding of manuscript relationships? I will put forward two possible ways of doing so. 30 years ago, I suggested that the model of the Venn diagram could be borrowed from mathematics and logic, as it had already been borrowed into linguistics. This uses circles or ellipses overlapping as necessary to represent the relationship between separate groups or sets of items. In the case of the manuscripts I was studying, this means that a circle or ellipse representing M4 in the Trivandrum manuscript would partly overlap with others for the other Malayabali manuscripts, with D1 and 2 and V1. In this way, showing, to some extent at least, the multiple allegiances involved. The drawbacks, as you'll realise, are that this is a decidedly visual model, rapidly becoming too complex to describe verbally, and that even visually, the patterns soon become highly intricate and less easy to interpret. The other is not just a model, but even more a new way of establishing relationships between manuscripts, developed for the Mahabharata by Wendy Phillips Rodriguez. This uses phylogenetic algorithms based on the principles of cladistics taken from biology to plot the degree of closeness between manuscripts, producing what she has called unrooted trees. The length of the branch for each manuscript showing the degree of divergence from the rest, individually and collectively. This is a more objective way of identifying the actual relationships involved and was, for example, the means of identifying the change of alignment of the sub-manuscript D6 that I noted earlier. It's reassuring to find that the Mahabharata critical edition is located near the centre, closer to the northern manuscripts, reflecting both the editorial preference for them and the general connectedness of the readings chosen. Variant readings and new patterns of omission or addition are found in virtually every manuscript examined. Many, of course, are trivial, but others are significant for building up a truer picture of the complex relationship between the various recensions and versions. There is, therefore, a continuing need for further examination of the manuscript evidence. However, both the approaches just noted rely heavily on the information found in the apparatus of the critical editions, and this will inevitably be true of any other initiative. We can only go beyond the critical editions of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana because of the firm basis that they have provided for further research. Thank you.